v. McLinn, 17-3083. Counsel?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dan Hansmeyer. I'm an attorney with the Kansas Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant, Edward McLinn. This case involves 18 U.S.C. Section 922 G4, which prohibits any person who has been adjudicated a mental defective or committed to a mental institution from possessing a firearm. Mr. McLinn below filed a motion to dismiss the indictment. That's why we're here. He pled that motion was denied without prejudice. So he entered a conditional guilty plea. It's a weird procedure, I think, where we're at. Our position on appeal is pretty simple. It's our position that the court should have ruled on the motion definitively, which it did not do. And for that reason, this court would remand for a definitive ruling on the motion.
I mean, it's a matter of law.
Correct. And it's pretty much that simple. We think the cases, I don't think the government disputes that's appropriate in this case. There's sort of three things this court looks at to determine when a motion to dismiss is proper. They're all satisfied here. Facts are undisputed. The government hasn't objected, and it is.
But even if we assume that it should be a matter of law, and even if we assume the district court did not treat it that way, which mm-hmm. I think are reasonable assumptions,
mm-hmm.
Why then couldn't we just make that ruling ourselves as a matter of law? Why would we need to remand?
Well, you could, other than I didn't brief it.
The district court makes a matter of law ruling and it comes up to us, we review it de novo.
You do. That's correct.
Just as if we were ruling on it on our own. So instead
correct.
Of remanding, why don't we just, we're going to be de novo anyhow. Why don't mm-hmm. we be de novo now instead of de novo later?
Well, right. I mean, I would ask for briefing on the underlying issue if you want to do that, because we didn't brief the issue. And I think, so the reason why we didn't brief the underlying issue and the alternative is because, the government, we think that if you're going to, you need something to review, right? This is a court of appeals. You should review something. What we have here isn't anything on the merits. And so we do think that it's something that this court would want, a ruling, and we think we could maybe win in the district court. I don't know. You know, Judge Murguia treated this as sort of a sufficiency thing. Has the government shown enough to get to a jury? I mean, what if he takes this without the deference to the government, maybe we win. And if we win, then the question is what happens next? Because there are still three counts. They would be reinstated, and because those were dismissed based on the conditional plea, they don't just go away if we withdraw the plea. So I think there are reliance interests on the sides, on both party sides. What happens next if we win? Maybe if we lose too. I don't know what Mr. McLinn, what he thinks at this point. He got a pretty good deal, time served. He's serving his term of supervised release right now. That's going to end at some point.
So why is he even appealing? The last thing he wants to do is to have this reopened.
I can tell you that we had conversations with Mr. McLinn about whether to appeal. And he wanted to appeal. I think underlying all of this is his constitutional right to possess firearms, right? Because if he has a conviction under 922 G4, he can't possess a firearm. Now, there are procedures in place. I think it's 925 C that allows some sort of restorations. But I think there's an issue as to whether that's funded or not. So I don't even know that he can restore his rights that way. So I think underlying all of this is Mr. McLinn's desire to have his Second Amendment rights, and that's why we're here.
Counsel, I just want to understand your position as well as possible. And one thing that I was wondering about was the disputed versus undisputed
mm-hmm.
facts here, because I understood Mr. McLynn to argue in his motion to dismiss that his detention was only for temporary observation. And then the government disagreed that that's what it was for. And then the district court observed that there wasn't anything in the order suggesting that the defendant was sent to Ossetomi for observation. That has something of a disputed fact character to it, doesn't it? And if that's the case, isn't that why maybe the court said it was denying the motion without prejudice?
That may be why he said that. I think as the case comes to this court, if you read the government's brief, I think the phrase undisputed facts shows up seven times. So I don't think there's any dispute between the parties that this is something where the facts are not in dispute. I think the idea of whether it's observation or not is probably a legal issue, not a factual issue. So I don't know where that word comes from, observation. I mean, at the end of the day, it's whether there's a commitment. I'm not sure why we picked that word. I didn't litigate this in the district court.
No, it's more than we have to address observation because the statute itself says that the commitment does not count against the guy if the observation is.
Okay, the Kansas statute?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that must be where that comes from.
No, the gun statute, I think.
Nah.
Well, I'll find it here and tell you in a moment.
I mean, I don't. The gun statute just says adjudicated as a mental defective or committed to a mental institution. There's no discussion of observation.
Well, let me try another question.
Sorry.
From you. So if the district court denied the motion on undisputed facts, in other words, is deciding the legal question, but still said without prejudice. Or even if he hadn't said that prejudice, and Mr. McLynn had decided at that point that he wanted to go to trial,
okay.
Would the ruling have precluded him from making a Rule 29 motion at the end of the government's evidence?
So I think the next step would have been instructions, and I assume that the court would have instructed the jury on that element based on his finding. And it wouldn't have precluded. I think what Mr. McLynn would have done to preserve the issue would have asked. He would have asked for the instruction, lost. The jury would have convicted him. He would have filed the 29 motion, and lost.
Well, I guess where I'm coming from with that question is whether that explains why the court might have said without prejudice that if we go to trial, this issue doesn't. Completely
right.
Go away. We're going to have something. The parties may have something to say about it at that
right.
point, and looked at in that light.
Mm-hmm.
Then why would we need to remand for clarification?
Well, we're not. I think our basic point is that he didn't deny the motion. On the merits. And that's why you need to remand, because there hasn't been a ruling. Now, I think it gets weird if you're saying, instead of appealing, if it wasn't dispositive, why didn't he keep going? Is that sort of what you're saying? Which I think is.
Well, I'm trying to make sense of
yeah.
the without prejudice.
Right.
The words without prejudice.
Why the, yeah, I don't, I think the court maybe. So the government told, there was this, the government, I think, sort of invited the air by telling the court this is a jury issue, it should go to the jury, it's factual. But it did so while admitting that the facts were undisputed. So I think he got caught up in maybe what the government was telling him, which is, our basic point is that there were no facts in dispute. Whether the judge thought there were, that's probably the problem here. The judge... That and the government telling the court this is a factual issue, it's for the jury. And the basic question on appeal is whether that's right or not. And under this court's precedent, Pope, the other two cases, Brown, Hall, it's clear that a Rule 12b motion should be decided pretrial. There's undisputed facts. It's a legal issue, and the government doesn't object, and those three things are met here, there's no dispute.
When you say without prejudice, it held open two possibilities. One, that he treated it as a fact matter and was going to say, I'm not going to take it from the jury because there's facts. We'll let the jury decide it. That would be wrong. Secondly, he might have said, might have been thinking, it's a legal matter, but I'm going to do it without prejudice now because it's early in the proceedings. Once I start to get more evidence at the trial, I will step in and make a legal ruling later. So just because he said it was without prejudice doesn't conclusively show whether he was treating it as a law or not. But turning back to the mental institution, 27 CFR 478.11 does say that the term of commitment to a mental institution does not include a person in a mental institution for observation.
Okay, that was the CFR, yeah. And that's another weird thing about how, you know, the trial attorney sort of relied on the CFRs, and I think that's something that criminal defense attorneys usually don't do that. So that's kind of a weird aside. I do want to note in our brief, I did something on page 9 of our brief. There's a word missing. I said the end of the first paragraph. The state of Kansas had labeled him a prohibited person. That's wrong. There should be a not in there. The state of Kansas had not labeled him a prohibited person. So sorry about that. That's a bad time to miss a word. But anyway, basic point, we think it should go back whether this court wants to keep the appeal and send it back to Judge Murguia to make a dispositive ruling, and then we come back and brief that issue, whether this court just wants a remand. But we do think at the end of the day, Mr. McClan made the argument he's entitled to a ruling. If this court wants to do it on its own under de novo review, we would ask that we can at least brief the issue because we did not brief him in the alternative.
If the court had not used the words without prejudice, what would your position be then?
Right. I think if he would have denied it on the merits, we would have briefed the issue. So, yeah, I think that's right. But because he didn't, we're asking for a remand for him to.
So we're here because of those two words.
I think so. Yeah. And I'll reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Stephen McAllister on behalf of the United States. I'd like to clear up a couple of points. I do think it's certainly true that the without prejudice language could be read as confusing, but, and I was going to say that the second thing is this case could have been litigated more clearly, perhaps by both sides in the district court. It's a little unfair to say the government invited error here. It is true the trial prosecutor put in the brief, this is a fact question. But it is also true that the defendant actually put on a witness, a fact witness, at the argument on the motion to dismiss. So it's not that unfair or not unreasonable, perhaps, that Judge Murguia may have been a little bit twisted around by both sides as to what exactly was going on here. So they put on a fact witness who was from the Osawatomie State Mental Hospital, who said she had worked there for 32 years. They put her on to talk about the discharge form, which says you're prohibited from possessing a firearm because of you've been here. And they were trying to make the point that that was standard no matter how you got to the hospital. It didn't necessarily mean you were involuntarily committed. But I will say, as a factual matter, if you were to treat it as fact, she was asked by both defendant's counsel and the prosecutor, was Mr. McGlynn involuntarily committed? And she answered yes to both of those counsel on that question.
Well, that doesn't answer it because commitment does not include a commitment for observation. So a reviewing court could say, yeah, we don't care what a fact witness said. She's wrong as a matter of law.
That's I agree with that completely. And that sort of to go further with where I'm trying to go with this, I think Judge Matheson's observation, they did argue strongly below. This was purely observation. This was nothing more. That's actually belied by many of the documents, which are ordering two courts ordered him sent for evaluation. The probable cause hearing in Douglas County District Court found that he was mentally ill and a danger to himself and others.
I don't know that even there was a finding that he was mentally ill. That was only a finding of probable cause that he was mentally ill. So the two ways that he could be in trouble were that there was a finding, that a commitment, judicial finding, and here we've only got a probable cause finding, and secondly, that it was when was a confinement to a mental institution, but not for observation only. And I think there's questions about both of those.
Well, I think there are, and Judge Murguia actually recognized that that, of course, is in the disjunctive, and there was an argument that he was adjudicated as mentally defective, but at the end of the day, Judge Murguia said, I'm finding that he was committed, so the other part of the statute applied at a minimum, is the way he phrased it in the ruling. The without prejudice is perhaps an unfortunate addition, but I think the best way to read what he was doing was he was looking at the law, because he cites the Sixth Circuit case, the Burks case, and says there you had two doctors who recommended that he be held. He was held for a matter of 5 days or something, and that to me is the way to go here. He's had way more process than that effectively. He's had, I guess he was before two different courts, a total of 3 times, so unlike the Sixth Circuit case. And I think what Judge McGee was saying is what I've seen thus far, at a minimum, he was committed to an institution, and therefore G4 applies. I do recognize it got a bit confused with, you know, this was an unusual motion to dismiss to begin with, and that they attached all these documents, and then they brought a fact witness to the argument on the motion to dismiss, which could be part of why he had in his mind there was more to be done. But I do think the fair way to read it is he ruled as a matter of law. I see no sense in sending it back to him.
I don't see how you can say he ruled as a matter of law when he did it without prejudice. You don't make rulings of law without prejudice. And when he clearly indicated, I thought, that he said at several points at this time and suggesting temporarily that he didn't think the facts were sufficiently developed yet.
Well, okay. Then maybe I overstated a bit. He did make an initial, at least, legal ruling that he was construing the statute like the Sixth Circuit had done in the Burks case. I mean, he clearly says that. I've looked at that case. I agree with that. And I do think perhaps what he was holding open the possibility, given that the parties, and in particular the defendant, had brought lots of facts to him, which, again, is unusual on a motion to dismiss, that there might well be more factual development to decide exactly what this was, that it happened in the Kansas courts and in the Kansas mental institution. The Kansas process has 3 stages, and Mr. McGlynn clearly went through the first 2, the emergency and the temporary stage. He was scheduled for the final stage, but then was released, and that trial, if you will, was never held. But I think under Kansas law, if you look at, for example, Kansas would have considered what happened to him involuntary commitment. I know that doesn't control the meaning of a federal statute, but this is an unusual statute in that it's relying on a notion that is determined almost completely by state law, which is civil commitment. And the courts have said we look to state law. And if you look at the Kansas Firearms Disability Provision, which is KSA 2163.01A13, it prohibits a person who has been subject to involuntary commitment for care and treatment as defined in KSA 59, 29, 46, and amendments, which is the entirety of the Kansas Civil Commitment Code. So it does not say you're only unable to possess a firearm if you went all the way to the 3rd and final step. It seems to suggest all of those steps count as involuntary civil commitment. So I guess
let me ask you a little different question. Appellant was doubtful about whether we should enter a ruling on the law, or if we say it's a legal question, whether we should enter that legal ruling on our own, and wanted additional briefing if we were to do so. What is your position on that? Should we or shouldn't we? Should we get more briefing or not? Or would you prefer to, your client prefer that it be remanded to the district court for their findings?
I would prefer it not be remanded. And
you'd prefer that we enter a ruling.
I would prefer
we say it's a matter of law and we enter a ruling.
Yes.
And do you agree then that there should be some supplemental briefing on that subject?
I will accept whichever way the court wants to go. We'd be happy to do a supplemental brief if the court would like, but I don't see any reason to send this back to the district court for a legal ruling that would then just presumably be headed back up here. So I think it's a law question. It's a very interesting question. There are a number of circuit decisions, as I'm sure the court is aware. They were briefed extensively in the district court, so the district court did see a lot of that. And that's why, again, I think he had in his mind that he was deciding the legal view he was taking was along the lines of the Sixth Circuit.
So what happens if we decide, as a matter of law, that he was not ruled incompetent or sent to a mental institution on the record before us? Then we remand. What happens next? Then is his case over and dismissed, or does he face... What about these other counts that were dismissed as part of a plea agreement? Do they get reopened, or what happens here?
Well, I suppose they could, because it would take care of the plea. The 922G4 count would be dismissed, so that one's gone. That would certainly take away, at least for the time being, the disability for him to possess a firearm. If you would rule as a matter of law he was not committed, then G4 doesn't apply, so that would take care of his Second Amendment concerns about his right to have...
But then we would still remand? Does that then vitiate the plea agreement?
It would.
It would or wouldn't?
I think it would.
And so then what do we do? Then we have to say we remand for further proceedings without the plea agreement?
Further proceedings, and the district court and the parties can argue that the plea agreement is now gone, and whether the government decides to pursue other possible charges or not would be...
What were the other charges?
Well, I think he's got some other possible charges on...
And what were the, in fact, charges that were dismissed here? Not possible charges?
I'd have to look at the indictment to be sure, but there may be straw man purchases, basically using his father, because they were assembling the guns and the parts together. And so I think the evidence would suggest that his father, even though he knew his son could no longer legally possess these things, was obtaining them for the son as well as for himself. So it would be along those lines. But
was the father charged below?
He was, but I don't remember how
was
that was.
Was the agreement that charge would be dismissed against the father?
I don't remember that part, Your Honor. Yeah. But I think, actually, it may all... I'd have to go back and look. It may all collapse if the G4 goes away.
Well, before we get there, I understand your argument as preferring that this case not be remanded, in which case it seems like there would be two options. One would be to simply affirm. The other would be to reach the merits. And I want to explore a little bit the first option and in terms of why you think that is a viable one relative to what the district court said. And I want to go over just a couple of things, because the district court said from the bench whether or not the defendant was adjudicated a mental defect, the court finds that the government presented sufficient evidence at this stage to show that defendant was at a minimum committed to a mental institution. So let's keep that in mind. And then the court also said, generally, the sufficiency of the government's evidence to support a charge may not be challenged by a pretrial motion. I'm having a hard time reconciling those two statements. First, it's sufficient. Then the sufficiency of the government's evidence to support a charge may not be challenged by a pretrial motion. Is that the reason that the court denied the motion? And if it is, then where are we?
Well, so I think, again, that is a problem with what Judge Murguia said. It can be read more than one way. But I do think you can reasonably read his opinion saying, I'm adopting the view of the law that the Sixth Circuit takes in the Burtz case. Now, it was an unusual situation in that he was not then just looking at the allegations in the indictment. Primarily the defendant had put forth a number of documents, had put on this fact witness at this time, And so I think he may have been uncertain about exactly what all had happened in the Kansas courts and in the Kansas mental institutions and whether that was observation or treatment. But what he was saying is, my reading of the law is this can count as a commitment, but there may be more facts that will come out to decide for sure at some point.
All right. So just to kind of give a sum up on your preferred disposition, the court should affirm because. How would you finish that sentence?
Well, I think the court should affirm because the judge made a ruling on the law that was correct, and that he took the view of the Sixth Circuit, and that in light of the allegations in the indictment and the evidence that was in front of him, there was no way you could say as a matter of law no offense was stated here. I mean, it basically, and I think you could say, as a matter of law, the offense is stated if the government can prove these things.
But doesn't that get us into the merits?
It may. I mean, because he's, you know, it has to presume that he's correctly chosen the legal standard, the Sixth Circuit standard.
I mean, well, and that he's also correctly evaluated the evidence.
True, although, I mean, in the government's view, he did, and there's even more that he could have said about that evidence, but that may mean, at the end of the day, the best resolution of this may be for this court to hold on to it, have each side do supplemental briefing. The record is what it is, the limited evidence that's there, and we can fully brief those circuit cases, and you can see the possible standards and approaches, and then look at Kansas law and decide if that's satisfied.
So what circuit case did the district court rely on, and what was the holding there?
It's the Sixth Circuit case. It's United States versus Burks. I think he actually mentions it in the ruling.
And what was the holding?
The holding in Burks was, the argument in Burks was the person had been, can't remember now which state's law, but it was a state that allowed certification by two doctors that a person was mentally ill and needed treatment, care, was a danger to self or others. And this person had been sent to a facility based on those certifications, no court proceedings, and had spent, I believe, about 5 days in the facility and then was released. And so was charged under 922G4. And then the defendant argued, what happened to me, two doctors for 5 days, that's not civil commitment. And the Sixth Circuit took the view that it seemed the primary argument was, well, I think it was both. I think it was the 5 days and the doctors, no court involvement. And the Sixth Circuit rejected both of those as being essential to being committed. So you didn't have to have a court involved, and a shorter time like 5 days could suffice as a commitment.
Notwithstanding the CFR.
Well,
so apparently that circuit is saying that a 5 day sentence, a commitment, can be more than observation. I mean, how psychiatrically can you meaningfully treat somebody for a disorder that's so bad that it would make you a danger to yourself and others? How could you assume that could all be done within 5 days?
Well, I don't think you have to assume that it's done when at the time they certify, they don't know how long he's going to be there. So the fact that he happened to get discharged after 5 days would not necessarily mean that he was not sent for care and treatment. And that's another.
Did the commitment itself have any time frame on it?
In the Virts case?
No, in our case.
Oh, in our case, yes.
How long was the commitment for?
So the way in under Kansas law, the first step was the emergency commitment, and within 24 hours, you had to have the probable cause hearing. So in the meantime, the judge appointed counsel for Mr. McLean. There was a hearing 2 days later. Then he, under the temporary, could be held, I believe, up to 14 days. So then he was transferred to another district court where the facility where he was being held was. And that court was supposed to, within 2 weeks, then conduct this trial proceeding to make
that didn't happen.
That didn't happen
So the answer is the commitment that is the triggering event in our case limited his time to 14 days.
Yes, I mean plus plus, I guess, the 2 days from the emergency.
Yeah. Okay.
But that's you know, that's more time than some of the circuits have found necessary. And we're in the merits now, but this is really the fascinating part of the case, is how to read this statute. The circuits are split.
We're over time, so if you could just finish your sentence.
All right. Well, I would just ask the court to do what it thinks best here. I'm not quite sure what the correct answer is, but the government will be happy to do supplemental briefing if the court would like that, or we'll be happy to take an affirmance back to the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We owe Mr. Hansmeier a little extra time here.
So I can talk about Vertz because I think the discussion of Vertz helps me, my position that this was something that Judge Murguia was doing to benefit the government, taking the sort of sufficiency, can the government meet its burden type thing, instead of just reviewing the thing as a matter of law and making a decision. So Vertz, so you have this body of law on 922 G4, which is pretty limited. There's not many cases on it. You have a number of published decisions from the circuits. Vertz is the only, it's an unpublished case. And not only is it unpublished, there's a dissent. And not only is there a dissent, there's a concurrence. So you have this decision that's not published. It's not even precedential in the Sixth Circuit, where one judge dissents and another judge concurs, talking about the commitment. So you have a very weird decision to rely on. If you're a district court sitting and you ruling on this as a matter of law, considering it, you know, de novo, it's really weird to think that this is the case he picks to rely on. And I think so the fact that he did pick this case supports what I'm trying to say, in that he really was just saying, okay, I'm going to give the government the benefit of the doubt, because that's what we do when we review sufficiency rulings. So when I do that, there's this case, I can rely on it. Okay, government, good enough. We're done. Deny it without prejudice. I think that's where we're at. I think the record's clear. The four sentences on page 60 of the transcript that start the current posture and that end without prejudice show that whatever he said before then, really, at the end of the day, he denied the thing without prejudice. He didn't make a ruling. So there's nothing for this court to review as a matter of law. That's really it. He was, as far as the facts of this case, just to clarify, the other counts are straw purchaser counts. I think that's 922A6. The government agreed to dismiss those counts, bargaining for his plea on this count. So, I mean, I would think those counts would be reinstated, but if it all goes away, I don't know. The other cases, Hall and Brown, were government appeals. There were other counts there. The government appealed on one count. The other counts remained. So I think that gives some support for the idea that the case doesn't just go away if this count is bad. He was committed for he was not committed. I should not have used that word. He was at Osawatomie for 7 days, and then the probable cause hearing came back. The doctor, there was an evaluation. The doctor said he's not. There's nothing wrong with him. They sent him home. That's what happened. Based on those facts, we don't think that that is sufficient under 922 G4. And we would, again, just do whatever the court wants to do. But hopefully it's something that benefits Mr. McLean. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted and counsel are excused.